Welcome to Baseball America's College Podcast. Baseball America, bringing you baseball news you can't get anywhere else for more than 35 years. Now it's time to talk college baseball.
Welcome to another Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. We've got John Manuel here.
Pledging to stay for the whole time.
The Baseball America College Podcast brought to you, like all of our college coverage, by Louisville Slugger, Power in Numbers. This week's Top 25, powered by Louisville Slugger, has a new number one in it. We got Oregon State moving up to one, passing Louisville, which falls to number two after a 2-2 week. Their first two losses, they still won their weekend series against NC State, but Oregon State, they're 20-1. They're on a 15-game winning streak, the longest winning streak in the country. So they move up to number one after sweeping Arizona, which had been a number nine. They've started Pac-12 play with sweeps of Arizona State and Arizona. It's the first time in like 20 years that's happened.
Unreal.
For like any team.
Yeah.
And not just Oregon State. The Beavers, they are rolling right now. Now, we had them as the Pac-12 favorite coming in, but after last year when they were a little shakier and they didn't make the NCAA tournament, there was a little, you know, a little concern, maybe.
Legitimate.
But they have answered all of those questions. They're healthier this year, and they're playing really, really well.
You know, Teddy, the things that stand out to me about Oregon State is, first off, they had kind of all the injuries they had last year in their pitching staff, and really Rasmussen kind of carried things, and now Drew's been out with Tommy John surgery. He was their best starter. Was it last year that he threw the no-hitter early in the year, or was it the year before?
Yeah, I think it was last year.
I think it was last year. This guy, had, you know, so they're without their guy who, if he were healthy, you'd probably project as their Friday starter, and they've been better on the mound this year. 1.48 ERA, looks like a typo. I mean, that's what they're doing so far this year. And KJ Harrison, slow start last year, not the case this year as a junior. I know it's only two home runs, but we had one walk off this weekend.
Yep.
He's been consistent in the middle. But to me, the separating factor for this team is, you know, it was just talented recruiting class of freshmen last year. And they've got some key freshmen this year. Again, Rushman behind the plate. I know he's not hitting a ton, but Rushman's been catching every day. Last year, their freshman class was such a big deal. And we expected a lot of big things out of them. But this year, the sophomore, freshman to sophomore jump has been most evident in Nick Madrigal. And for me, Teddy, I mean, like, it's a decent junior season, junior class, especially pitcher heavy. If you're picking one best college baseball player in the country, I think I might choose Nick Madrigal. I mean, the sophomore that he's really competing with, I would guess, is his total opposite. I know he's off to a slower start, but Seth Beer and Lucan Baker in the sophomore class are these power plants. You know, freshman of the year last year for Beer, Baker hitting in Omaha. Those, to me, are like the top three sophomore position players in the country. And they're totally – those other two guys are so different from Nick Madrigal. But energy, contact, defense, speed, and he's got three home runs. I think Nick Madrigal, for me, he might be the single best player in the country. And that's saying something, I know, but scouts have been so high on this guy the last couple of years. And the X factor, what's the school?
Elk Grove.
Elk Grove High School in Sacramento, with all these prospects. He played with some great players in high school, and he was clearly ready for this college jump. But he's made the leap this year from a good freshman to a great player as a sophomore. He was a preseason All-American already.
Yeah, he's been really, really good, and he's already accepted a USA Baseball invite.
Yeah.
Baker's already accepted a USA Baseball invite. I assume Seth Beer will accept an invite to come back. So, you know, we're going to get to see those three guys get after it on the collegiate national team this summer, I'm sure, and that's going to be fun. Another guy on that team for the Beavers that's taken a sophomore jump is Caden Grenier.
Yep, absolutely.
Who came in and was, you know, those two guys, it was like, what are they going to do at shortstop? And they had Trevor Morrison there last year, too. And, you know, they found a way to play all three of those guys, but Grenier, more than the other two especially, really struggled last year.
Yeah, could that take a back seat to these other infielders?
I mean, and, you know, when you're a freshman and you come in, it's hard. College baseball is hard, but he's out there. He's hitting .299 now, and he's a really strong defender.
Yep.
He didn't have an exceptional cape, but he really has made a nice jump, and that's been a big part of them being good, is guys like him and Larnach, you know, supporting Madrigal and Harrison.
That was the other guy I was going to say, is that Larnach has made this nice leap. Again, just the last couple of years, it's just been like, you know, as a freshman, KJ Harrison was so good. He kind of did carry the offense in a lot of ways by himself. And last year, when he did struggle, it was almost like the rest of the team, just there wasn't a running mate there to kind of take some of the some of the load off them. Even the 2014 team, if Conforto had a bad day, Dylan Davis could deliver you with a big home run. So it's just harder for one guy to have to carry the load. To me, and I've forgive me for getting mixed up on my Mike Linnea vines over the weekend. But just going back through my timeline, it's just so impressive that, again, on the mound is where all these position players were guys out of high school. These guys were expected to be good. Nick Madrigal, much was expected of him. KJ Harrison, even Rushman, Grenier, a lot of was expected out of those guys. Christian Donahue, who was one of their better hitters last year, now junior, remains a productive player, not a big draft prospect. He's, 5'7", 5'8", not as twitchy as Madrigal, but he's a good player. But it's really been the surprise to me has been on the mound, Teddy. That's where I just did not expect, after all the injuries they had last year, that Oregon State would be as good as they've been. But Heimlich, Mike was tweeting about him, and Mike's in the air. That's the only reason he's not in the podcast. He's flying back from Oregon. That Heimlich didn't have his best stuff. Thompson didn't have his best stuff, his crispest stuff. Those two guys were lights out this weekend.
And that's against one of the best offenses in the country. Arizona has been putting up crazy numbers coming into the weekend, and Oregon State controlled that offense. They gave up some runs, yes. I think Oregon State's ERA shot up half a run this weekend by allowing something like 10 runs. But, that Arizona can hit. That's what they do. But this Oregon State staff, they really pitched. And, like Mike was saying, they maybe didn't have their best stuff, but they've got the ability to compete. And you got Max Engelbrecht there at the back of the bullpen.
He's been Johnny Reliable. I don't know how you say that in German, but he's been Johnny Reliable. Maybe that's what Engelbrecht means. But he's been outstanding. And the thing is, Teddy, they have a little two-game cushion now in the Pac-12. And, obviously they've been just, so hot. I mean, the rest of the league, Stanford's been kind of what we thought. I guess what I'm curious about is Arizona. What does this say to you about Arizona that they got swept? It seemed like Arizona didn't go quietly. That was scrappy. I guess our consensus on the call was that this says a lot more about Oregon State than it says about Arizona that Arizona was swept.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, the first two games were one-run games. They got walked off on. What it does say to me is Arizona has some things to work out in its bullpen. Mm-hmm. Cameron Main at closer is really, really good, but he's been good for them. He was good in Omaha, but the way Arizona has to piece its pitching staff together.
They've got to start and they've got to finish.
Right.
So they've got J.C. Cloney. He remains extremely consistent. I mean, I know he's 86, 87, but
it works.
It works for him, man. That guy's really good and really competes. And Main, like you said, competes. He's had, those two guys have established roles. Filling in, I mean, last year they really didn't, correct me if I'm wrong, Teddy, they really figure out what was going on in between last year until April anyway, right?
No, and I don't think that Jay Johnson minds that approach. Mm-hmm. I think he's okay with mixing and matching. Bobby Dalbec last year did a lot of relieving. He started some. That was all over the place until the end of the year. And
yeah, really late April when they said, okay, you're in the weekend. They started him on that Monday at BYU.
Right.
And then kind of settled him in as a starter after that.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a chance that they do something like that again. There are some arms there to work with, but they are going to have to figure that out a little bit here.
They really haven't settled. I mean, Rio Gomez has started every weekend. But outside of that, they're still searching for that third starter, which I guess, you made a great analogy that Palminieri made to you. We were talking about North Carolina on the call last night and how they are struggling with Sunday starters. It's natural to struggle to find that back of the rotation, just like it is in the major leagues to find the back of the rotation answer.
Yeah, Manieri at LSU they've been trying to find a third starter for years. They seem to have finally settled on one this year with Eric Walker, a freshman, stepping into that role. But he was telling me earlier that, in the big leagues, your teams are always trying to find fourth and fifth starters.
Right.
And, so in college, that's a third starter, and it's not easy to find. We talk about 1-2 punches all the time. There are not many teams that have, steady 1-2-3s. And Arizona now still trying to find kind of that second guy. Mm-hmm. You know, that's really what they had last year when they were going their best.
Yeah, they had that 1-2.
It was Bannister Dahlbeck, and Cloney and Dahlbeck as a swing man wherever they wanted.
It.
And, you know, they need to find something to replace Bannister and Dahlbeck still.
That's a Bannister and Cloney with like that 1-2. And then they had like this kind of X factor in Dahlbeck. And they've got, you know, they have Ming in the bullpen. You know that if they want to, they will extend him, you mm-hmm. know, later in the year. He'll get some good naps in, and they'll extend him. But finding that second, that complement, that consistent complement to Cloney in their rotation, that seems like that's going to be the key going forward. Oregon is the other team out west. Obviously, I referenced them earlier. But they've made this – they seem like a little bit different animal, Teddy. This is kind of what we always kind of thought Oregon would be under George Horton, which is this, especially last year, they had all these big-time arms. We kind of kept expecting their arms to come around. They're really pitching very well now. They got blown out Sunday by Washington, couldn't finish off the sweep. But I think we thought coming into the year that UW could be was a super regional contender, and I think we still think they could be that team. But a pretty young team, very youthful freshman and sophomore classes that really are the most talented guys on that UW roster. Whereas Oregon seems like, you know, there's some youth there as well, but I mean, I think it's a little bit more experienced team, and it really does seem like their pitching's made a leap this year. And you have to finger Jason Dietrich, their new pitching coach, as a primary reason why they're better on the mound.
I mean, they're 4-2 now in the Pac-12, and that's a really nice start for them. You know, they're kind of just on the outside of the top 25, and everyone is 4-2 in the Oregon State is 6-0, and then there are like four teams that are 4-2, and a lot of them could go either way at this point. Oregon, you know, is going to face bigger tests. They passed a big test this weekend,
right?
But they're going to have to go on the road here and play some difficult Pac-12 teams. UCLA is 4-2. You know, they're looking okay after losing the opening series against Arizona. They come back and get a sweep against Cal, who is not looking good at all.
Which we kind of thought that Cal would take a step back this year.
Yeah, they are very young.
We just thought that the step back for Cal would have been this year, not last year. The problem is they took a step back last year.
I did not think the Cal's step back would include a 20-0 loss at UCLA.
That is just so startling. But I want to talk to you about the Bruins. I'm glad you brought them up. That's a youthful lineup. This is a team where, Teddy, it feels like if John Savage can coax UCLA to a regional bid this year, look out in 2018. Because I like the look now. I mean, Bouchard and Canning are their two main draft guys. And I did want to talk to you a little bit about how Griffin Canning really does seem like he's taken this big step forward on the mound draft-wise. He's going to be a back of the first round, maybe early kind of comp round selection, maybe even a little bit higher than that if he finishes strong. He's halfway through the season, 49 strikeouts in 39 2/3 innings. Did you see that coming out of Griffin Canning? And B, which of these freshmen has impressed you the most out of the group of like the Creedlers, Taglia, Idens? Which of those guys has maybe impressed you the most?
Well, you're saying if he can coax them into a regional this year, look out for next year. I'd say look out for them in your regional this year. If UCLA gets in, you don't want to see Griffin Canning in that first game.
Good call.
And then if Jake Bird gets healthy.
Great call.
You don't want to see him in the second game. You know, and Justin Hooper's been a lot better this year. Yeah. I know he's still a work in progress, but it's going in the right direction. So Griffin Canning, I'm not surprised. I may be surprised at how much the pro guys have jumped in on him. He is not the biggest guy. He's
right.
He's very slight.
He's like a 6-foot righty. He's like a, you know, and it's like 6'180", right?
I mean, yeah.
He's not a big guy.
I mean, I saw him last year pitch against Dakota Hudson on Friday night out at UCLA, and Dakota Hudson looks like a first-round right-hander, and he was the last pick of the first round last year. Griffin Canning is not that kind of size.
He's listed as 6'2", 180, but I'm surprised that he's listed that tall.
He really knows how to pitch, though.
And right.
And he is the latest in a long line of guys at UCLA that really, really know how to pitch. I mean, John Savage knows what he's doing in picking them and then in coaching them. And so Canning has been incredible for them this year. And, you know, he really can be, you know, a top guy for them. You know, he's one of the best pitchers in the Pac-12, especially, you know, with what he's doing this year, 1-1, 272, 49 strikeouts and 39 2/3. I mean, he's out there pitching, and they don't need a ton of offense, but they do need to find some.
I do think that I wonder if they'll be just the team, if they'll be able to pick it up enough consistently and be consistent enough, but to be a regional team this year. But Sean Bouchard's finally made that kind of jump. He was a very highly regarded player coming out. 5 home runs. It's interesting to see that UCLA's actually hit for some power this year. But I was all in on Jeremy Idens coming in this year. I'm not sure if it's Idens or Widens. I don't want to hear the pronunciation key that's on their website right now. I'm sure I could click it and hear it, but I don't want us to hear that on the podcast. I'm impressed that they're having some success without Stumpf having a big year. He's got 3 home runs, but he hasn't hit 200. I think that was the player they thought was the most ready to hit from day one. But Creedler and Taglia, those two guys are athletes.
If they can get Taglia going, Taglia's hitting 218 right now. If they can get him going, I think that's the guy that really can be like a big all-around threat in that lineup for the next few years. And if they can get him going later this season, I think that would be a nice boost for their lineup.
Of the 1-5 teams in the Pac-12, Utah, Arizona State, Cal, which one has the rosiest outlook going forward? The defending champion Utes, Cal, or the Sun Devils?
You know, I kind of want to say Utah here. You know, I like Jason Rose on Friday night. I like the rest of the rotation, too. And, you know, they've played probably the toughest schedule to this point of any of them. They had to go to Utah and to Stanford for the first two series. That's pretty tough.
And they've lost 8 of their last 9, but a lot of those games were on the road. The one win was at Stanford Friday with Jason Rose. But, that's probably the separator between those three clubs, really, isn't it? Between them, Arizona State, and Cal. They do have that Friday guy who could stop a losing streak, and he kind of did that Friday night.
For sure. I mean, he's a veteran guy that's pitched on Fridays before. You know, Cal's throwing Jared Horn out there on Fridays, and Jared Horn's going to be a great player for Cal, but he's also a freshman. There's a difference between throwing a junior who, you know, has Friday night experience already and throwing a freshman.
I'm going to go back to – I meant to say this on UCLA. I'll double back to UCLA for one quick second. Give these freshmen a year of playing this year and bring them into the 2018 season with Molnar back from Tommy John and Justin Hooper figuring things out. Whew, come on, man. I mean, UCLA's talent in the sophomore and freshman classes is really, really good. This is an older Utah team, and they've got to get well fast, Teddy, because next weekend they're home to Oregon, then at O-State. They do have Cal after that, and then at Arizona. That is a tough road to hoe for the rest of April until they get to – I do think the schedule is a little bit lighter in the second half with Wazoo, USC at home, Arizona State at home, and at UCLA. So it's the first half schedule is tougher. You already said that it's already been tougher for Utah. It doesn't get any easier the next 3 weeks. So Utah's going to have to figure it out and play a little bit better. Which of the 4-2 teams do you think is the most fool's gold? Maybe Oregon, USC, Washington, or UCLA? Those are your 4-2 teams. Is there one team that's been a little bit, not fluky, but that you have a little less faith in out of those 4 teams?
I mean, I guess from those teams, it'd be USC. 3 of them, I think, or at least 2 of them we projected as regional teams coming into this year. I know USC was not one of them. I don't remember if we put Oregon in a regional this year coming in or not, but I think they've done a little more than USC to this point.
Yeah, USC having a big test for them next weekend going to Arizona. It's their first time traveling in Pac-12 play. Well, this was a huge college baseball weekend, though, Teddy, because we were all fanned out around the country. Hudson Belinsky down in Gainesville to see LSU and Florida. We had Mike Lanan out in Oregon on the Oregon Trail at Oregon and Oregon State. You and I with big series here locally, from a draft perspective, that's where I wanted to steer it a little bit next, because it was so huge from a draft standpoint for that. I mean, it just seemed like everybody was down scout-wise in Gainesville to see Alex Lang and Alex Fado. We had a report up by Hudson Belinsky, who was on the scene there. Let's talk about that series a little bit if we can, because pretty huge series win for Florida. You just saw them last week, and they win the series at home against LSU, but get bombed on Sunday when they had a lead and give up that lead, so they had a chance for a sweep. But obviously encouraging signs for the Gators, but I guess both teams have to feel pretty good about the fact that their aces both got right this weekend. I mean, how much of a sigh of relief do you think that both Kevin O'Sullivan and Paul Maneri breathed on Friday that Fado and Lang were good?
I think it was probably a bigger one for LSU because Lane had been shaky more than just the last week. Yeah. Fado had had his worst start at Auburn, but he had mostly been pretty good throughout the first month of the season, whereas Lane, you know, had been hit around a few times already. So for those two guys to go show out, I mean, that was very big.
Yes.
That was very big for them, and it was very big for their teams.
So that's the thing, is like, this is like one of those classic cases of, you know, where being selfish baseball-wise as a player can actually be, if you put the team first in a selfish way, it kind of works out for everybody. And like, for Alex Lang, he needed it, but his team needed it more, but they go hand in hand. Alex Fado, I guess, sounds like he pitched a hair better, Teddy, but I don't know if you saw Hudson's report on it, but to me it sounds like Fado finally had a little fastball, a little oomph to the fastball, not just velocity, but also command of the fastball, and he just has to have that to set up that slider, whereas with Lang, he has to have the fastball strike, but he also has to be able to throw the curve for a strike, because if he doesn't throw the curveball for a strike, teams just eliminate that and sit on the fastball. And you're, I mean, personally, I don't know which of those guys you think is going to be the better pro. Do you lean toward Fajardo, or do you like prefer Lang? Which one do you lean toward there?
I do lean toward Fajardo. He's just so, like, he's so polished. You know, you're right. He does have to command it, but he doesn't maybe have a Logan Shore command, but he does pitch with above average command typically. When he's at his best, he's certainly doing that.
Yeah.
And it sounds like that's what he was doing on Friday night. You know, Lane is has been, you know, he's a little more streaky, I feel like. You know, sometimes,
and that's fair,
sometimes he gets into, like, when he's in a groove, he's almost unhittable because he's landing that curveball for strikes and nobody's hitting that.
I think to this point in their careers, Lang's best has been slightly better than Fajardo's best. But Fajardo's been a little bit more consistent pitcher. Alex Lang, of course, as a freshman, was just, you know, all world. He was just so good. It's huge though for both those teams. But I guess I also think that Sunday's win for LSU, I mean, that's...
Well, I think that it's very big for LSU, for both that Lane was good, because then Poche seems to be coming back to earth a little bit naturally.
And that, as I said, that's just, I mean, like, the fact that guy started off so well, I mean, like, just tip of the cap to Jared Poche. What a start to the year. So just a little humanity is allowed. We'll allow it, you know.
But if he's not going to be the guy that's throwing, you know, 15 hitless innings or whatever, then you need your ace to pitch at the before him, and then on Sunday to, you know, to pick those guys up and, you know, to be able to get to the Florida bullpen, which is very young. You know, and LSU's lineup able to take advantage of some of their you know, mistakes and shortcomings at this point. It was big all around for them to be able to go out and get that last win.
One thing you also pointed out, LSU preseason was our pick in the SEC West, but the SEC West has not been what we thought it was. Right now, they are not a Dennis Green division. You cannot crown them. LSU's at four, sitting there 4-2, but Arkansas and Auburn both off the good starts at 5-1. Both of them ranked. Auburn obviously had the sweep of Florida. A little less convincing this weekend, but they did go on the road and beat Georgia, a very big, struggling bigly Georgia team. But Ole Miss has had its ups and downs, but really, I mean, to be expected. Number one recruiting class, very young team.
We're trying to figure them out. They're the hardest team to figure out, but
yeah,
that's because they're freshmen for
that's
the
right.
most part. They're freshmen and sophomores, and this is what happens.
But the West is, you know, Texas A&M, 1-5, Teddy. Who are the real Aggies? Because I thought they showed some flashes earlier in the year.
I mean, they beat Texas Tech 9-0 on a Friday night.
Right.
They got to Davis Martin, Houston. Teams don't do that. But they have not started the SEC well. They got swept by Kentucky. Kentucky moving into the ranking this week.
Yes, that's to come for sure.
They're beating Ole Miss. They get swept by Kentucky and they get hit. Like, A&M is going. They have to pitch this year because
yes.
the lineup lost a lot from last year.
Right.
And, you know, there are talented hitters in the lineup, but it's a younger lineup. They need to pitch, and they've got the guys to pitch, but, you know, they've not really done that to this point.
It's just surprising. I mean, that's just Rob Childress's bread and butter. He was a pitching coach before he became a head coach. So I just always expect his team to figure it out on the mound. So the fact that they haven't done that to this point is a little troubling. Again, we're about halfway through the season. And these are some veteran names. You know, these are some names that we know in Bingham Hill and these kind of guys who have done it to some extent in SEC play. Do you think they can turn it around, or are you starting to get a little pessimistic? At what point do you start to worry about A&M long term?
I mean,
because they got to go to LSU next weekend.
Yeah, you want to feel good about their ability to turn around. It's a good staff. There's talent there for sure. They've done some things this year that would make you think that, you know, they can be a team that can, you know, contend. But, you know, they also have to get it, like you mentioned, some of these other teams having to get it turned around quick. They've got LSU followed by Auburn.
Yeah.
You know, they can't really afford to lose their first four series in SEC play.
That's what I'm saying. And I think it's going to be real challenging for them. Meanwhile, the teams are at the top of that. Arkansas, you know, I texted with some scouts earlier in the year about Arkansas. And this is really more of a good team, but it does seem like the pitching staff has taken a step forward there this year. And it might just be a new voice in their ear. I'm not bagging on Dave Jorn in any way, shape, or form. Dave Jorn did tremendous work for a long time in Arkansas. I wasn't always a fan of how quickly they brought guys back on short rest and this and that and the other, but Dave Jorn, a lot of Arkansas pitchers in the big leagues. Mike Bolsinger, guys who weren't high drafts. Cody Anderson's an Arkansas guy, right? JUCO transfer. Obviously, before him, you had Cliff Lee. Dave Jorn did a really good job there. But Wes Johnson, as a new pitching coach, after Dallas Baptist to 1 year at Mississippi State, didn't seem to work out at Mississippi State, stays in the SEC, goes to Arkansas. They've been just flat out better on the mound, Teddy. And this weekend, he kind of gritted one out on a Sunday, one of these Sunday 50-50 games at Missouri. But to go on the road and win a league series is always big. They've got now, and so their first two, I think, of the schedule kind of did them some favors. They go on the road at Missouri, at Alabama. That's not the same as going on the road to LSU or going on the road in some of these SEC East powers. It feels like Arkansas' start is sustainable to me because they're pretty good on the mound, and they've really figured out, I think, and the schedule is favorable for them.
Yeah, I mean, they've been impressive to this point this year. They only have the one losing weekend. It was in Frisco, and you know they lost to a couple of pretty good teams in Arizona and Oklahoma State and Nebraska right out there. Like, that was a good tournament, and it was a good test for them. I think that was probably pretty helpful for them to go out there and do that, because for the most part, they've just been at bomb, which is pretty typical. That's what Arkansas does.
That's right. That's what they do.
But you know, this weekend, stopping what had been a red-hot Missouri team, I mean, they hadn't lost since opening day, and Arkansas goes in and wins 9-2 on Friday in a game that was really messy. Like, there was a two-hour rain delay in the middle of it. You know, so they go out and take it to Missouri, a team that, you know, had been winning games and had been in a lot of tight games, and they were finally able to be the one that gets to that staff, and they beat Tanner Houck. I mean,
right.
It was I think it was
great start to the weekend series.
Absolutely. And you know, they did lose Saturday, but they're able to come back and finish the series on the road, which is what you want to do.
The scout that I talked to about them liked Blaine Knight as a competitive, you know, weekend starter. He's been outstanding, 18-1 strikeout to walk in SEC play. And they've shifted Taccolini into like this kind of moment of truth, kind of long relief, short relief. He's got a couple of saves in league play. I think that it's been impressive to me what Arkansas has been able to do to start the year.
And they're physical. They're also doing it without a couple key arms on the mound. Keen McKinney
right.
is out.
Right.
Isaiah Campbell, who could be a first rounder next year, is out.
Right.
You know, so they're missing some guys, but they're still rolling along.
And one of the guys I talked to was like, look, they really don't have a position players. They don't really have like big time pro guys, but Carson Shaddy, Luke Bonfield, these guys are big physical guys. Even the freshman Dominic Fletcher, he's totally different from his older brother. What was his first name? He played at Loyola Marymount. Brian Fletcher, I guess, the middle infielder, yeah. Now with the Angels. I'll look at my prospect handbook because he's with the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim now. And his name, yeah, it's David Fletcher. But Dominic's a completely different player from David. Physical, left field projection kind of guy. They've got some real power on this Arkansas team. So, you know, I think they have some staying power. Do you think Auburn has staying power, having seen them in person?
If Auburn gets good news on as far as Keegan Thompson's health, yes.
Yeah,
If they can keep rolling Keegan Thompson, Casey Mize, and Davis Daniel, who had a really nice start on Sunday, if they can keep rolling those guys out there, I think they can. I don't think that they have depth on the mound yet to sustain an injury to their ace and keep rolling to the way they have been. They're that staff is still, you know, working to build a team there.
Yeah, it's more star power or top heavy. Depth is not necessarily their forte on the mound.
Right, right. And that'll come in time. But for now, I think they can as long as they stay healthy. I mean, when you roll Keegan Thompson and Casey Mize out there, I mean, that's a really strong 1-2 punch.
That'll do. Absolutely. Teddy, the other story in the SEC is really, you know, we've touched on Missouri a little bit. They lost their first series of the year this weekend, but Kentucky, get out of town. Bad weekend for Big Blue Nation on the court. Great weekend for Big Blue Nation in baseball. They're 18-7 overall. And I guess what stands out, Teddy, is that they've done this against a great schedule after losing their first four games, after getting swept at North Carolina, sweeping at A&M and winning 2 out of 3 against Ole Miss after losing the Thursday night showcase. What's Kentucky done so well under first-year head coach Nick Mangione?
Well, when I talked to Coach Mangione, you know, he wanted to talk about how good the pitching had been, which it definitely has been. Those guys, I mean, they had to replace their entire rotation. They had some like premier draft guys in there last year, and now they've got a different set in there, different coaching staff, obviously, as well. And these guys they're pitching very well. Their closer, totally blanking on the kid's
That's
name.
That's okay.
But they
Logan Sallow.
Yeah, Logan Sallow, a senior.
Those are crazy numbers.
It's really insane what he's doing. He has yet to give up an earned run this year, yet he has 2 losses. but he's been lights out for them at the back end. But they're also hitting. I mean, they lead the SEC in a lot of offensive categories. And they're hitting .326 as a team, which leads the SEC. They've scored 201 runs.
That's crazy.
Which leads the SEC in 25 games.
They've got .430 on base.
Again, and leads the SEC.
And I just love just looking at their numbers. 37 steals, and the opponents have 4. I mean, so they're not the – I mean, 37 out of 50, the quick math, 74%. You could stand to be a little bit more efficient that way, but they're very aggressive offensively, Teddy. They're bunting. They're stealing bases. They're hitting and running. I watched some of that game Thursday. It's just an aggressiveness. It's a completely different attitude. I guess it starts with the coaching staff. I mean, they really are not a – I always used to think of them as a pitching defense three-run homer club. That's not who they are anymore.
No, it's a very high-energy staff, and, I mean, that's who Nick Mangione is. And, it's just a very different look than what Gary Henderson had. And, you know, Gary Henderson did some really good work at Kentucky.
Absolutely. And he's doing good work now at Mississippi State as the pitching coach, being with the new staff, figuring it out down there under the first-year head coach, Andy Cannizzaro.
But Nick is 38 years old, and you know, with that comes a lot of energy. And I think the team has really responded to that. He said that they have really adopted a true family atmosphere down there. He's got young kids. Pitching coach Jim Belanger has young kids, and those guys are around a lot, and the players enjoy that, he said. And they've just really been able to play for each other, which helped them get through that slow start when they lost 4 games. By a total of 5 runs.
I'm glad you mentioned Jimmy Belanger. This is a rising star in college baseball coaching. This is a guy who was the pitching coach at Monmouth when they produced Brad Brack and Pat Light. So Monmouth has 2 big league pitchers. This guy helped do that. He didn't do it all. Players did it all. There are other coaches who were there too. But that's where I first talked to him was Pat Light and comparing him to Brad Brack. And I was like, kind of chuckling to myself, you got Brad Brack. You know, I mean, first of all, Brad Brack. It's fun to say. Second of all, like he was going to be anything. And Brad Brack's been a good big leaguer now for a couple years, better than Pat Light. But then Jimmy Belanger goes to Maryland. Mike Schworn, the success that Maryland had. It wasn't just Schworn. It wasn't just the unicorn. But they, Jake Stinnett. I'm pretty sure that Jimmy Belanger was involved with Jake Stinnett. So the fact that he's gone to Kentucky and he's having success like that, really doesn't surprise me at all. So I'm into Jimmy Belanger. I just think that's a successful program. So I think what Kentucky has is sustainable. Another part of Kentucky watching them go forward, the whole SEC East is really, really going to be very competitive. South Carolina loses Friday against Alabama. They get back and win the last 2 games of the series. I guess, Teddy, that the surprising thing there is, I guess it's not surprising that South Carolina won when Will Crow and Clark Schmidt started. The surprising part is that they started on Saturday and Sunday. They pushed Clark Schmidt back to come back from his health, from his week off that he missed with a slight injury. But South Carolina, Kentucky, Missouri at the top of this. You have to go to 4-5, Teddy, to find Vanderbilt in Florida. And aside from South Carolina, usually the top of the SEC East is South Carolina, Vanderbilt, Florida in some form or fashion. And lately, unfortunately, Georgia and Tennessee usually at the bottom. They are back at the bottom. But Vanderbilt and Florida combined 5-7. They both won series this weekend. They both had a chance to sweep that series. Teddy, which of those teams do you like better going forward? I guess going into the year, you liked Florida better. You probably still do, but what does Vanderbilt have to do maybe to kind of right its ship? Because it seems like they just haven't quite, especially Kyle Wright hasn't been the star that we thought he would be. Jaron Kendall certainly has heated up. I think he's got 7 home runs. He hit the home runs in 2 out of 3 games this weekend. But this is still a team that seems like it's still feeling its way, even after winning the series against A&M.
Yeah, getting Jaron Kendall going this weekend was big for them, big for that offense. Obviously, he is their best offensive player, and he's got to play like it.
Yeah.
And they need Kyle Wright to pitch like their best pitcher. He's been good. It just hasn't quite translated to results yet. I mean, you figure that it will, but to this point, that's been shaky, right, as we've alluded to several times here. But when you look at what Vanderbilt has coming up here, I mean, they got Kentucky this weekend, followed by South Carolina. Those are both on the road. And then Florida comes to Nashville in a couple weeks. They really need to get this going.
Yeah.
They need what happened against A&M to continue to go, because these next 3 weeks are going to be very, very difficult weeks. The schedule eases up after that. They go at Georgia, Tennessee, and Missouri for the 3 weeks following that,
right,
then Arkansas and Alabama. So the second half of this SEC slate is much easier for Vanderbilt. At least that's the way it appears right now.
No question.
But if they can't afford to dig themselves a big hole, like, especially if they're still trying to host a regional.
Right. It almost reminds you a little bit, like, their 2012 team came on gangbusters at the end of the year, had a little bit of a rougher start, so they wound up having to go on the road for their regional, and that was a bit that really affected them. They couldn't win that on the road, but you just look at Julian Infante's had a really big year. Kind of, you know, was expected to kind of be the first baseman last year, and I guess he played some of the year, but
up.
He had a wrist problem.
Yeah.
He seems like he's healthy this year because he's swinging the bat really well. But it feels like offensively, they're not a tremendously deep offense right now. They're a little top heavy there, and I'm surprised that Kyle Wright hasn't been better. I mean, for lack of a better way to put it, just to be simple about it, the scouts I've talked to, he seems like he's kind of fallen behind Fido and Lang, and those guys, I think, kind of thought that maybe Kyle Wright would go out ahead of those guys. He still could. He's got the cleanest arm of those three, and he's the most conventional, but he and Tanner Houck have not taken that step forward, and Lang and Fido really did this past weekend. Small sample size, but they were able to this past weekend. Teddy, you and I were around here for the two best pitchers in college baseball right now are Brendan McKay and J.B. Bukauskas for the 2017 draft. And performance-wise, I guess J.B. Bukauskas has been the best pitcher in college baseball, period, full stop, this year. Is there anybody who's been better?
Well, because McKay gave up 3 runs this weekend and his ERA, like, tripled as a result, I guess J.B.'s numbers are now just better than McKay's.
And that's really, it was like a two-man race. It's amazing when you go 7 innings, give up 1 run, and you're not, and your ERA just tanks, you know, for
McKay. So McKay goes, he strikes out 14, he gives up 3 runs. It was a quality start,
yeah.
And it was by far the worst start of his season.
Well, McKay actually still leads the country in strikeouts per 9 at 15.47, and Bukauskas ranks 7th at 13.5. It's easier to look up on the NCAA because Bukauskas' name is Bukauskas. Not very many Bukauskas's. There are quite a few more McKays. If you had to pick one guy to win one game right now, who would you pick, McKay or Bukauskas? Just on the mound, can't give you credit for McKay's
stadium. We don't get McKay in the lineup. I still think I'd probably go with McKay. He's pitched in a regional and a super regional.
Right.
And Bukauskas has not.
You mean I skipped my senior year of high school to not go to regionals for 2 years? I mean, that's like my first question for JB when I sit down with him. I'm probably going to do that in the next couple of weeks. Like, have you ever thought, like, you sat there for 2 years and you skipped the year of high school, you didn't go to prom, all these kind of things, just for this? You know, I mean, probably not what he was expecting. So
things haven't worked out the way he probably thought.
But I mean, things haven't quite worked out for McKay either. I mean, he didn't skip anything for it, but, you know, that's a team that you thought the last 2 years would have been in Omaha. You know, they're hosting
absolutely
super regionals, and to have the heartbreaking losses they had in back-to-back years against Fullerton and then UCSB last year. I mean, that's a guy that, you know, the whole team is hungry to get to Omaha, and you've got to figure that McKay really wants to finish this season in Omaha.
No question. And that's a team where they lose Friday, and I thought that they showed a lot of grit this weekend because they have a 6-3 lead on Saturday against NC State and blow it with a 3-run homer by Joe Dunand. 7 home runs, no doubles. Longtime listeners of the Baseball America College podcast will recall that I hate players from a statistical standpoint. Nothing personal against Joe Dunand. I like Joe Dunand. He's a good player. He's got a very difficult to be A-Rod's nephew. That's, I wouldn't wish that on anybody. That's just hard. You know, and through no control of his own. That guy came up at a huge moment, but 7 home runs and no doubles tells me that he's swinging for home runs. He's swinging for the fences a lot, and that's why he's hitting .218. But for Louisville to give up that 3-run homer on Saturday and come back the very next inning and win the game, that was, they did not fall apart. Emotional college baseball players often do. They didn't, and they came back and they boat raised NC State on Sunday with an 8-1 win. Drew Ellis is just putting up ridiculous numbers. I tried to talk to a few scouts about him and where he might go. The fact that he plays first base, left field, third base, he's not very good at third. I think he's probably
made 2 errors on Sunday in his one day at third base.
Probably not. He's probably more of a left fielder or first baseman pro-wise. College-wise, I mean, that guy kind of worked his way into the lineup the second half of the year last year. That guy could hit.
He's even played some second base for them. I think there was one game already this year where he played 4 positions in one game.
I believe it. And people love that about Louisville's program.
Yeah, he's very intriguing. I like him a lot. He shows power. I mean, that whole lineup really shows power.
Absolutely.
You know, Devin Hairston, maybe not quite so much, but he does everything else that you want. You know, he's an incredible defensive shortstop.
He's really productive. He's a productive player on both sides of the ball.
Absolutely.
I mean, he's an efficient defender at shortstop. But the thing I like most about Devin Hairston is that freshman year for him, he was an out. And he and Sutton Whiting struggled in the middle of the field defensively. And that was a big reason why Louisville didn't go to Omaha that year. But he had a concussion that year. I mean, he's fought through all those issues. He's such a steady defender. He competes. He competes defensively, offensively. He's a fun player to watch. Their whole team usually plays with energy. But, you know, Lyman's made a jump for them this year, too. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. Was a Lyman a guy that, like, they would start last year, and then they'd replace him, they'd pinch hit for him, or he'd be a defensive replacement.
Right.
Now he's, like, hitting the top half of the lineup.
Yes. I mean, this is what happens at Louisville, basically.
Player development.
Well, player development, and also, you know, guys have to wait their turn. They're sitting with Tyler Fitzgerald, who's a top 200 player in the BA 500 last year. They're trying their best to get Tyler Fitzgerald into the lineup because that's the shortstop of the future, and he's a future superstar. But he can't start every game because they have to find a way to get all these guys in the lineup. And you know, Brennan McKay, sometimes he DHs, but he plays first base too. And if he's playing first base, well, maybe Colby Fitch is DHing, and Drew Ellis is at third base, and suddenly Tyler Fitzgerald's on the bench. And
I know.
This is just what happens. Some of these guys can't play. What Florida did with pitching, you know, Louisville has really seemingly done with in terms of their lineup. They just are able to replace guys like Corey Ray and Nick Solak. I mean,
these aren't easy guys to replace. Will Smith.
They're just plugging in new guys. And you know, Devin Mann is their starting second baseman. Last year, you know, he filled in when Solak was hurt, and then he went right back to the bench. And now he's, you know, an integral part of the lineup. I mean, that's what Louisville does. It's player development, and it's guys willing to wait their turn and learn when they have the opportunity, taking advantage of the opportunities, but understanding that, you know, there are other talented players here.
Sadly for me, when I hear you say Devin Mann's name, I think of, I got a man. What's your man got to do with me? I mean, that's just terrible. That song is so bad. But that song is in my head when you say, when I've seen Devin Mann's name and saw him play for them last year, and I can't get past that.
He's got some pretty good flow, too.
Does he have good flow?
That
team seemed like they had some. I don't know if anyone has the flow Nick Quintana's got at Arizona. That's ridiculous.
That home run, so the video of him hitting a home run at Oregon State right after an Oregon State fan yells, "Don't they have any barbers in Arizona?" is just it's
priceless. It's like the best video of the year in college baseball. The Atlantic Division versus the Coastal Division, Teddy, kind of like the SEC East and the West. The Coastal's got North Carolina with a two-game lead. They haven't swept the team yet, but two-game lead on Virginia, Pitt, Duke, and Miami. I think we still believe in Virginia. They're 19-6 overall. They've had some issues. I mean, like, they gave up 19 runs Friday to Duke.
The 26-hit effort from the Blue Devils was, on a Friday night, was surprising.
That was just stunning. But the balance of powers in the SEC seems like it's in, all in the Atlantic, which makes it difficult for NC State. NC State's 4-5 in the league, 13-12 overall. They were preseason number, what, 17 for us? 15?
14.
14. Louisville, Clemson, Florida State, Wake Forest off to a good start. NC State's already lost a series at Wake Forest. You saw State all three times this weekend, right? They have Sean Adler, who's become a consistent starter for them. He's a 5- or 6-inning guy, but he's been consistent for them. He's a weekend starter for sure as a senior left-hander. I don't know if he's an ideal Friday guy, but he's what they have.
It worked on Friday night.
Right. Joe Donald, really good. He's not throwing as hard as he used to, but spots the breaking ball, competes his butt off, commands it.
That was a nice piggyback on Friday night. That's probably not like ideal for them, but that was a nice piggyback, and it worked, and they got a win.
But the rest of the weekend, NC State's kind of a cluster on the mound still, and we're halfway through basically the season, just about. They haven't figured out their pitching yet.
They have not. Brian Brown started on Saturday. It wasn't great. He has to be really fine with his command. That's just who he is, and he wasn't. And that Louisville is the wrong team to not be commanding the baseball against.
Yes.
Because they will wait you out, and they will draw their walks, and then when you make a mistake in the zone, they will bane it.
I know Tommy DeJunius, the numbers look pretty good for him Sunday. Did he show signs of being a productive member of NC State's pitching staff?
Yeah, again? I think when he came in, that's kind of stabilized some things. You know, he definitely pitched well. They need him to be good, that's for sure.
Yes, they do.
They could use Dalton Feeney, you know, their nice freshman, to get going.
They didn't even use him this weekend.
They did not use him. They didn't use Gauthier this weekend, either of the freshmen there.
That was a little stunning to me.
They brought Wilder out on Sunday to start, and it looked okay for like an inning and a half. But you know, that at this point, it's hard to count on Corey Wilder even for 5 innings.
Correct.
I don't think he got out of the first in the last time they started him in a midweek against George Mason. So they're you know, another team that really needs to piece their pitching together. And it was tough for them when Brown went out so early on Saturday and then to lose that game. If they could have come back and won that game in extra innings, that would have been huge, because they at that point had exhausted. They went through a lot of arms on Saturday.
Yeah, they used 8 guys on Saturday.
Yeah, and you know, when you do that, that means that you don't have that many on Sunday when you really need them to back up Corey Wilder, and it showed.
It showed, and they got, you know, DeJunius did eat up some innings for them. That was crucial. We don't have Mike Lanana here to defend Wake Forest's honor, but real quick, Wake Forest 6-3 start. I think Mike and I are a little bit more sanguine on their future than you are.
In the rankings for the first time in a decade.
That I did not know. Do you think they're a regional team, or are they going to still be on the precipice for you like they kind of were last year? They're on that bubble virtually the whole year.
You know, I think they probably are a regional team, but I also think they're at the back end of the ACC contenders. We're ranking 6 ACC teams right now, and I don't know how. There are not going to be 10 ACC teams in the tournament this year. Going into the weekend, they were fourth in conference RPI. I don't know that they actually get better than that. They have some anchors this year where they didn't have last year. Boston College, Pitt, Notre Dame, Virginia Tech. These are going to weigh down ACC teams' RPIs. Whereas last year, the ACC teams all fed each other's RPIs, and they all got crazy high, where you get North Carolina with a top 20 RPI being left out. It's not going to be like that this year in the ACC.
I think you're right about that. And let's just while Wake Forest celebrates being in the rankings, let's acknowledge that they go on the road for three of their next four ACC series, including at Miami, at Louisville, and at Clemson.
Their first three ACC series have been against State, Duke, and then this weekend Georgia Tech. Two of those were at home, and Duke was the road trip. So they really haven't had to go very far on the road. I mean, that's a nice easy hour and a half drive from the DBAP for them.
And when they did go on the road earlier in the year, when they went to Houston, they went 1-3 in that tournament. So they've got to show they can win away from home, away from, you know, when they're not just off the bus when they fly somewhere. So that's going to be, I think it's going to be a challenge to see if Wake Forest can do that. I think their pitching is improved. Right now, the number one conference, Teddy, we should wrap this up pretty soon, But right now, the number one conference is the Big 12. And that seems like that's some cannibalization that's kind of gone on there a little bit too. But you have two top five teams in TCU and Texas Tech. That's, I guess, the number one reason. In your mind, what's the biggest story in the Big 12? Has it been Oklahoma and the start they've gotten off to this year?
I think it's First of all, I think it's the number one RPI to this point. I think that is very impressive for a conference that in back-to-back years only got three teams into the NCAA tournament. Last year, all three of them did go to Omaha. But yeah, this year, they got five is the high watermark since they lost Nebraska, A&M, Missouri, that crowd. And they can do that again this year, maybe even six. But when you look at the Big 12, I think the turnarounds from Oklahoma and Baylor both have been very impressive. Now, Baylor has lost their first two Big 12 series, maybe coming back to earth a little bit after starting the year 14-1.
Right.
But Oklahoma goes out. They win their first Big 12 series this weekend on the road at Baylor. That was a very interesting series to watch as these two teams that had been down last year both missed the tournament, and they're trying to work back. It's Oklahoma's schedule has been light, but they do have a series win against Long Beach State. As weird as that was in opening weekend, they won two games. And now they have a series win at Baylor, who has not been losing at home.
Right. They've been playing very well. And I know they've lost two series in a row, like you said. But, I mean, I would rather have gotten Baylor later than sooner. The Sooners got them sooner, and they still won the series.
And it sets up a very big series for Oklahoma this weekend with Texas Tech coming to Norman. That is huge for Oklahoma. Texas Tech is rolling. They are as hot as almost as pretty much anyone but Oregon State.
Yeah, that's a weekend preview kind of lead series. And I can't wait for 2 weeks from now when Texas takes on Oklahoma. It's in Austin, and Skip Johnson, pitching coach now at Oklahoma, revisits his old stomping grounds in Texas. That's going to be really interesting for me to see. And I'm just so fascinated, mostly because I share an office with J.J. Cooper. I have the corridor of power right there, the door between our two offices. Briley Ware keeps doing it. He's hitting he's hitting 373. He's got five extra base hits. But this dude has been a little shot in the arm to their offense. He is a bad body, no position, not a prospect dude, but he hit like 600 at Neosho Junior College. Now that guy's hitting 370. He's been a nice little shot in the arm to Oklahoma's offense. I'm fascinated by Oklahoma because they have had this random road trip through Georgia. Lost to Georgia Tech, which hasn't played very well. Series at Kennesaw. They go into SEC play, Big 12 play, and they start off, with a series win. That's a team to watch. Now, I'm fascinated by Texas, Teddy. Texas off to a 17-10 start under David Pierce. What have you seen out of the Longhorns to this point so far?
They've been a little up and down. They obviously really struggled. Not really struggled. They ran into the buzzsaw that is Texas Tech 2 weekends ago.
Right. Got swept there. Was it Kansas or K-State this weekend they swept? I think it was Kansas. No, I think it was K-State.
K-State. And, they lost that series at Stanford. They split against Rice. They've been a little up and down. But, I think, first of all, that's a little bit to be expected. They're still figuring some things out there. And they're still set up to be a pitching and defense team. Yeah. David Pierce, I'm sure, wants to become a little more offensive, play a different offensive style than Augie played. But they have what they have right now.
I mean, you don't think David Pierce will ever say, I'd bump Babe Ruth in this situation? That was the Jim Morris gave me that story. I'll tell that story. And I won't even do it in my Jim Morris voice, even though I'm very tempted to. But that one year, like 30 years ago, Jim Morris was the head coach for some USA team, and Augie was his assistant, if you can imagine this. This would be a good way to get into our kind of Mount Rushmore question that you hinted at earlier, and a good way to finish. Jim Morris says, I forget who the hitter was, but it was a guy who went in on the big leagues, and they had first and second in a tie game in extra innings against Cuba. They were trying to beat Cuba, and Jim Morris is like, he calls a timeout and basically talks to his hitter, and he comes back, and they said, are you going to have him bunt? And he goes, no, I'm not. And he looks back at Augie and says, would you? And Augie says, sir, I would bunt MF and Babe Ruth right now. And, of course, the hitter hits into a double play and ends the inning. And Jim Morris looks back at Augie, and Augie's like already going to the other end of the dugout. Like, that's Augie's I told you so. Anybody who takes over would probably bunt less than Augie Garrido. They still have 18 sacrifices in 27 games. I mean, they're still winning games with you said, with pitching and defense. But this weekend, back-to-back shutouts against Kansas State. In the two games they lost, Texas Tech, the first two they lost, they gave up. They lost 2-1 both those games. The freshman from Vegas, Nolan King, has been pitching really well. Morgan Cooper has draft helium. He's going to go get in the draft. He's kind of like Texas version of Griffin Canning. You know, not super power armed, but you know, is going to go pretty good in the draft. And he's a lot bigger than Griffin Canning at 6'4", but he does not. He's not thought of as an overpowering guy, but he had a 2-hit shutout this weekend against Kansas State with 11 strikeouts. So I'm really intrigued by Texas. I'm probably a little biased because I do actually have the Longhorn Network for some unknown reason, and I see their games. But that league does seem deeper, Teddy. Some powers at the top.
When I talked to Schloss last weekend, Jim Schlossnagel said that every team in the Big 12 is better, top to bottom. They are all better this year. And what it's showing right now. I think he's right, and it's showing. And they've won non-conference games. Their RPIs are showing it. And that's going to help them, you know, feed off each other later. I mean, that's how you build RPIs, is you win non-conference games, and then you feed off each other.
Yeah.
And it helps when you win good non-conference games, and that's what most of them have gone out and done.
Teddy, the good way to wrap up is we talked about two of those coaches we just talked about in that story are potential guys for your college baseball coaching Mount Rushmore. And for me, there's three easy consensus guys for college baseball Mount Rushmore. Rod Dedeaux, USC, 10 national championships.
Hard to argue.
11, by the way, some people count it. I think he's on there for sure. Just put Tony the Tiger. Just put Tiger up there since he called everybody Tiger. Skip Bourbon, I think unassailable, going to be on there. 5 national championships at LSU. Built LSU, was assistant in Miami when they built Miami. Augie Garrido, you got to be on there. He's probably just giving the bunt sign to somebody. But Augie's on that. 2 national championships at Texas, 3 at Fullerton. I mean, you just can't get better than that. All-time wins leader, 1,900 wins. Great for making speeches. So your fourth guy, I've had this debate with Mike Rooney, who does ESPN games. I've debated this over the years with Jim Callis. I think you can make the case for Ron Frazier if you want to go old school at Miami. I think these Mount Rushmore lists tend to go too old school in general, so I would want to bring someone fresher into the discussion. I think you can make a case if you want to go old school for Jerry Kendall at Arizona. They won 3 national titles, 76, 80, 86, produced a bunch of big leaguers, and he did it in the meat of when Arizona State and UCLA and USC were still dominant. In the six-pack, where USC won 70-74, they win in 76. USC wins again in 78, so USC's still legit. 81 Arizona State, their last championship. Arizona's won since then, 86. Plus, you throw in that Jerry Kendall won a national championship as a player at Minnesota. And I think he was a coach on another Minnesota team as an assistant coach under Dick Siebert that went there. He hit for the cycle as a player in Omaha. He's the last one to do it. I'm all in on Jerry Kendall. Plus, he's the nicest guy in the history of the game. But you can make a case for Jim Morris, University of Miami, for his career. First, Georgia Tech. Built a great Georgia Tech team, and then 2 national titles at Miami. If Jim were to get Miami back to Omaha one more time, they've gone the last 2 years. If we were able to win one in the next 2 years, I don't see that happening. But like if they'd won one the last 2 years, that would have been a third title. I think his case is a very good case. Pat Casey's another active coach with 2 national titles. So is Mark Marquess, but he's not going to be active after this year. But you had a question, I guess, about Pat Casey.
Yeah, I mean, the question comes from about Pat Casey, just where does he rank? And I think, you know, all those guys that you mentioned are probably ahead of Pat Casey at this point. Some of it is longevity. You know, Pat Casey has been there a long time, but you look around at the rest of these guys and they're like 30, 40-year coaching veterans.
Yes, he's not quite as long in the tooth as those guys.
And I don't think he will be.
Right. But this year could really go a long way in shaping that.
If they get back, first of all, it's big to get back for him. They haven't been in a few years.
Yeah.
And
2013 is their last college season trip.
And if they were to win it, that's 3. And there have not been many coaches of recent vintage that have 3. Ray Tanner only has 2.
Right. Ray Tanner, we left out of that discussion. And then Andy Lopez has 2 championships. Yeah. And Andy Lopez and Ray Tanner, 2 very different. I mean, like Ray Tanner had a lot of success at NC State, couldn't quite get them to Omaha, then goes to South Carolina. And has a lot of the same things that Ron Frazier did in terms of making college baseball like an event and drawing fans. Like the things that Ron Frazier did at Miami, Ray Tanner did the same things in Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
Andy Lopez, he doesn't have the fan argument, but he won at Pepperdine and at Arizona 20 years apart, and he took Florida to College World Series a couple times. Andy Lopez are the guy who took three schools to Omaha. You've got I think it's Larry Cashel is one. I think he took Oral Roberts and Oklahoma and Fullerton. I'm pretty sure about that. And then Ron Polk did Georgia, Southern, Georgia, and Mississippi State. Andy took three, but Andy won at two of them. The other two guys didn't win. Andy Lopez is a dark horse candidacy for that. And then I think Pat Casey, if this year's team won a national championship, or he won one
He'd be the first since Skip to win three, right?
I believe that's the case. And the degree of difficulty at Oregon State is higher than these other joints.
And he's done a lot to build the Oregon State program.
And he basically forced Oregon to bring baseball back.
Yes,
by winning
and
twice
he's,
there.
And frankly, winning right now, it's harder than it was in the 70s and 80s.
There's just no question. That's another reason why I try to slant things toward today. Like the 80s probably
like it's great that
talent.
USC ran through all of those titles, but they wouldn't be able to do that right now. They aren't able to do that right now.
Right. I mean, the reason you never see a team win five titles in a row is because it's too stinking hard, to do like what USC did back then. Now, to dominate from 1958 to 1978, 20 years like Dato did, that's something different. That's I respect that as much as I do the five titles in a row. And that's why I respect Andy, 92 and 2012, and then the success he also had at Florida. I think his case, he showed he could win West Coast, he could win Pac-12, he could win the SEC. I mean,
there's almost no one that's done that.
There is no one. He has the most unique resume. Pat Casey's is unique in that it's Oregon State. And this was a team that was just not a factor beforehand. And he's had a couple losing seasons early in his tenure there. Oregon State, they can't be borderline. They can't have a 35, 36 win year. They'll get left out.
That happened.
It just happened last year, and it's happened before. My first year here, when Andrew Checkitz was his number two starter, now the head coach at UC Santa Barbara, it happened to them because they were Pac-12 North runners-up to a very good Washington team. They went 35-14. So from a weather standpoint, they can't always play 56 games. He's built that into a culture that is college baseball matters. I mean, he's in the discussion, but to really break his way into it, he doesn't have 1,000 wins. Like even Elliott Avent's close to 1,000 wins.
I think he's an 8 away, 9
yeah,
away.
Yeah, I think a 7 or 8 away. You don't think of him as an all-timer. He's a really good coach. He's had 14 regional trips to NC State. The separator between him and Pat Casey is Pat Casey has 2 national championships. The degree of difficulty is kind of equal to me at both those schools, Oregon State from a geography standpoint. But to me, he needs a third championship to break him out of this pack with a Marquis, Morris, Andy Lopez. And out of those three guys, Andy Lopez, Jim Morris, those are both, I give a little edge to Andy, to be honest with you. I think degree of difficulty, and I love Jim. University of Miami's done a great job. I can't resist doing my impersonation. I love talking to Jim. He's one of my favorite guys in college baseball coaching. But Andy's resume, I think, is just undersold. I think he – and Ray Tanner's the other two-win guy. And, hey, by the way, Ray Tanner, as an athletic director, about to have – he hired Frank Martin, I'm pretty sure, as his basketball coach. South Carolina in the Final Four. And Don Staley is his women's basketball coach. And they could go to the Final Four. So that would be another little feather in Ray's cap of being great college baseball coach and then a great athletic director. That would be something different on the resume from these other guys. So,
yeah, only Skip really has that.
Yeah, so for me, going historically, I would rank Coach Casey a notch below Ray Tanner and Andy Lopez, but very similar to Mark Marquis. Not the longevity of Mark Marquis, but very similar cases.
He might get there yet.
Yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely, if he wants to.
Also, happy birthday to Mark Marquis on Friday. He turns 70.
So he's got Wayne Graham still got 10 years on him. So
Wayne Graham has 10 years on him.
Here's to Rice winning some games because they're 7-19 and it's painful. So my voice is about out. I'm cheered out and I'm podcasted out, Teddy. So I'll let you take us out.
All right. Well, thank you to John. I've been Teddy Cahill. All of our content over at baseballamerica.com. There's the new top 25 there, powered by Louisville Slugger, power numbers. Thank you to Louisville Slugger for sponsoring this podcast and all college baseball content over at baseballamerica.com. We'll come back to you, I guess, on Thursday with a Facebook Live, and we'll be back here next week with a whole new top 25, a whole new podcast, and maybe a whole new discussion about old coaches. Who knows? Thank you very much for listening.
This concludes our program. Want more in-depth baseball coverage? Be a better fan. Visit BaseballAmerica.com to get more comprehensive baseball coverage.